Mr. Informant.
May it please the court, Mr. Malik. This case involves the attorney's duty of diligence owed to his clients, the duty to promptly handle a representation, the obligation on the part of the attorney to communicate and to explain to a client a matter to the extent reasonably necessary for that client to make informed decisions, and the requirement that contingent fee agreements be reduced to writing. Of equal significance, this case involves an attorney's duty to the legal profession to respond to lawful demands for information from a disciplinary authority with regard to its investigation of a complaint lodged against that attorney. The facts in this case establish that in 1992, the respondent entered into an attorney-client relationship with William Hawkins and Grace Eckstein to represent them in connection with a case against Chrysler and others for the wrongful death of their two sons in a one-vehicle auto accident. The claim against Chrysler was based on a theory of products liability in the manufacture of the vehicle in which the decedents were riding. 14 years later, in February of 2006, respondent withdrew from representing Mr. Hawkins and Ms. Eckstein without ever having carried out the representation and without ever having given his clients their day in court. Of equal significance, the respondent failed to diligently complete the representation for 5 years after the trial court had denied Chrysler's motion for summary judgment in October of 2001. The respondent himself admitted to his clients in a September 2004 letter that the wrongful death case had languished and that it needed to be brought up to speed. In that same letter, respondent stated his intention to fully assemble the file and to get back to his clients with a detailed schedule. None of those things happened in this case. The informant's position is that the diligence violation did not occur as a result of the respondent's failure to advise his clients that he considered the case thin or a long shot. In fact, he did tell his clients that he thought the case was thin. Likewise, the ethical lapse is not found in the respondent's negative evaluation of the case, or his whether he was certain that the case would get past the motion for a directed verdict at the end of the plaintiff's case at trial.
Counsel, when you spoke about the failure to complete the case, was there any objection at all raised by the clients to the motion to withdraw? Did they come there and say, oh, you know, don't let him out of this case, Judge. He's not done yet. They didn't oppose the withdrawal, did they?
The fact is the record does not show that they objected to that withdrawal at the time. I think that the failure to complete the representation is that during the course, Judge, of those 14 years, Ms. Eckstein, Mr. Hawkins are asking for trial dates. They're asking that this case proceed to trial. And Mr. Martin, basically, while he tells them it's thin, he never tells them, I'm not trying this case in its current posture with, frankly, a blacksmith as our expert witness.
But they had notice of the motion of withdrawal, and they could have appeared through them or other counsel to either enter an appearance or object to his withdrawal.
They certainly could have, Judge.
But you're not saying his withdrawal was improper. You're saying the 14 years prior to that, he needed to either bring it to trial or withdraw. But he
Correct.
Couldn't keep it pending for those 14 years up until that final.
Under the rule, I mean, the trial court, in its judgment, thought that he could withdraw without prejudice to the clients. Nevertheless, during the course of these 14 years, I think it was incumbent upon the respondent to get further along and either try the case or, frankly, say I'm withdrawing from the case in year two or three when I can't get an additional expert.
Your argument is based on disputed facts. Is that correct? That where he's saying, I told them all along it was a thin case and we just needed to sit and wait and hope for something to happen in the future, where there's evidence that indicates he didn't tell them he was never going to try the case.
Exactly, Judge Breckenridge. I think whether it's disputed or not, it's clear in the record from letters and the testimony that he was telling them we need another expert. This case is thin as currently postured. But what he never tells them in letter, verbally or otherwise, and Ms. Eckstein denies it in her testimony, is that he ever said, I will not try this case. This case will not make it to a courtroom. And it's there that I believe the 1.3 violation occurs.
And he's, I'm sorry, Judge Sheldon, where he also is not telling them, I think I'm never going to try this case without an expert. let's just let it pending and remain pending and see what happens, but don't expect me to go forward and try the case unless some new something happens.
Right. I think the record reflects that he allowed the case purposefully to ride the docket in Texas County because there was no requirement on the part of the court that case was going to be pushed to trial. It was based on a readiness card filed by one of the parties. So he was allowing that to ride the docket, thinking, well, I'll maybe be able to find an expert. They even say in their brief, maybe the law will change. Maybe the rules of evidence will change in favor of our clients.
Maybe some other case will arise where they have proven the same defect in the vehicle.
Correct.
Does the record show that he told them that right now I won't bring it to trial, but, hey, we can leave it pending as long as nobody tries to get it dismissed? Or
I believe that he did tell them that this case would ride the docket without it being dismissed. What happens in under the rules, in our view, is that you can't do that forever, that 14 years is too long to expect that the law is going to change or that I'm going to find an expert witness out of the blue that will support Mr. Rhodes' testimony. To me, there is a continuum here, and 14 years is too long, and it's a violation of the rules to allow the clients to think they're going to have their day in court when, in fact, in his own mind, he never was going to give it to him under the current posture of the case.
Oh, there was a one-month, the committee recommended one-month suspension with probation. That's not allowed by the rules. It has to be 6 months or more. Is that correct?
Correct. And the reason we were not in concurrence with that decision was for that very reason. The panel recommended one-month state suspension with probation. We agree that state suspension is appropriate with probation. We suggest 6 months probation.
Now, the troubling aspect is the non-compliance with your requests and your as a district commission. What's your general discipline for that kind of a violation?
Your Honor, I think that in a vacuum, a failure to cooperate with the disciplinary authority is going to warrant initially, depending on the circumstances and type of case, perhaps an admonition, assuming that the underlying case itself is not serious enough to warrant additional discipline. In this case, because of the graduated discipline approach that we take, Mr. Martin was previously privately reprimanded by this court and received an admonition in 88 and 89, and with the fact that in this case the failure to cooperate was just so extreme, seven letters being sent over the course of many months, the committee had no choice, frankly, except to file and vote to file an information.
But the record reflects he started practicing in 1968, so for 39 years he's had those two issues in 88 and 89. And that's it for 39 years until this issue now.
That's correct. Nevertheless, certainly the failure to cooperate is something that this court has shown that it takes very seriously. And in our view, if you look at the case law, the Shellhorse case, that was a public reprimand case involving MCLE delinquency, failure to comply with legal education requirements, and a failure to cooperate. We think this case, with the additional violations of 1.3, 1.4, and 1.5, is more than a public reprimand. As we discussed in the brief, it's less serious, I think, than the Cruz case, which involved outright dishonesty in terms of the dealings with the client.
And that's why you would say a stage suspension?
That's correct.
But ABA standards also say that a substantial experience in the practice of law may be an aggravating circumstance.
That's correct. In other words, it's balancing, but it's certainly the ABA standards identify substantial experience, which Mr. Martin clearly has, as actually an aggravating circumstance, because I think the theory is he should have known better than to let this case rest.
Is there any explanation why he let it pen so long, other than, I mean, I understand he wanted the law to change, but you don't leave all your cases pending for that reason?
I think that his explanation is that he was hopefully going to find a more credible expert to try the case. I have my own feelings about it. I believe that this is a case that when I was in private practice, I used to identify as a 10-foot pole case. It's just not one that I want to fool with unless I have to. And in this case, I think that what ends up happening is after 14 years, he gets into a big brouhaha with Ms. Eckstein. They file a bar complaint, and he uses these events as a reason to withdraw. In particular, at one point, claiming that the bar complaint itself was a reason for him to withdraw. He could not represent them in the context of a pending bar complaint.
Could you clarify for me again whether it's disputed that he did not intend to try it because he didn't think he could get past a motion for directed verdict unless something new arose, but whether that was communicated to his clients and they knew that was the status, or whether they didn't understand that there was no intention, or there was contrary evidence they didn't understand that?
I believe that they understood, and the record reflects, that he did tell them the case was thin, that
right.
he needed to get another expert if he could.
Right.
I don't believe that he ever told them, we're not going to be able to get past a motion for directed verdict. Perhaps I don't believe that the record reflects
that. What's your obligation to represent the client after they file a bar complaint? Are they then hostile to you? I mean, don't you want to let them get new counsel if they're unhappy with you and they've actually filed a bar complaint versus you're going forward and representing them?
Your Honor, again, first of all, that has to do with the withdrawal and the terms of the withdrawal. However, to answer your question, I don't think that the filing of the bar complaint necessitates counsel withdrawing from that representation. And I've been asked by many attorneys, do I have to get out of this case? Can't I go talk to the client, do whatever? Yeah, you're welcome. You're encouraged to continue with that representation. The fact that it's a bar complaint obviously doesn't mean that there's a violation. And in this case, frankly, I just don't think that was cause alone for a withdrawal. He did have a big disagreement with them about the fact that this case wasn't progressing, and in addition, relied on that for the withdrawal. What we're asking here, and I'll just skip to this, is, again, I think when you balance the ABA standards along with the case law from this court to the Cruz case, the Shellhorse case, I think a state suspension with probation is appropriate. I might add that I believe, in addition, an additional term of the probation not included in our record submitted to the court is that Mr. Martin be required to attend the ethics school that we'll be putting on this fall. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Pratzel. Mr. Martin will celebrate 40 years practicing law this April. He's been an attorney, and during that 40 years, as you've heard from Mr. Prassel, he's had an admonition and a reprimand. That was almost 20 years ago. I would like to, I guess, address.
But why didn't they respond to the disciplinary counsel when requested? Do you have any extenuating circumstances and health problems, anything that caused him not to respond to the disciplinary counsel?
His the press of business after he recovered from his health events. His mother had passed away that shortly after.
But it was like a year and a half. I mean, he was back to work after about a month. Certainly during that period, he had health reasons.
He's not saying it as an excuse. And as he said in his brief, he's submitting himself to the court for discipline on that particular issue. He's asking you to take those factors in mitigation of his particular violation of that rule. He should have submitted it. He did submit a lengthy, the same individual involved in this bar complaint, William Hawkins, filed a lengthy bar complaint against him on the criminal case that was disposed of years earlier. He's in the penitentiary, has time to write all these documents. Well, he devoted almost 40 hours in a lengthy response to that complaint, and it was dismissed. I can tell you, he wishes with all his heart that he would have done the same kind of response to this complaint, because I'm relatively confident we would not be here today.
So your client has acknowledged the wrongfulness of his conduct?
I would say that's a fair statement. He admits it in the brief that we filed.
In terms of not responding to this?
Yes, in terms of not responding.
In terms of the case, he seems to think it was proper to let it pend for 14 years, though, and just hope that some expert will appear. But he didn't look like he was actively pursuing experts during that time.
Oh, no, I beg you
definitely
with
sure.
Differ, Your Honor. That's not the case. What happened is he got involved in this case as an attorney. In his 40 years of practice, he's kind of built up a reputation as a guy that will take on tough cases. Attorneys on the east side asked him to get involved in a case that they were having some difficulties with.
Mm-hmm.
That case was filed in Illinois. He joined with co-counsel with Mr. Lucco's office. That case was pending there, was subject to a motion to dismiss for lack of venue. That motion was granted. There was an appeal filed. That judge, and I'm sorry, you read the history of the case. I don't mean to bore you again.
No,
anyway,
go ahead. But those were early 90s, right?
Those issues resulted in the refiling in Texas County. And those issues were not really resolved until approximately 1995, when a stay was lifted in Texas County because the Illinois case was finally decided against the plaintiff's state. We had to take it to Texas County. In addition to that, from 95 to approximately 2001, there were depositions, discovery being performed. And
how many depositions and how much discovery during that 6 years?
Probably
there was
about
a lot
10,
going on?
Yeah, yes, probably 10. Okay. This file composed 4 boxes that we brought into.
And you got no compensation for any of that time put into the case?
Only half of the expenses were paid by the client. The deposition costs, filing fee, I think they paid some travel expenses. But there was no attorney's fees charged.
When was the summary judgment motion ruled?
It was ruled in 2001. And as shortly after that, and shortly after the deposition of Tony Rhodes, the one expert who gave the deposition, he realized with the cross-examination that took place in the deposition that we needed another expert to make the case. There was a lack of a causal connection between what happened at the factory and what happened on the road. We needed a different type of expert other than Mr. Rhodes, a mechanical engineer, to fill that gap. He immediately told the clients about that problem. Did he, and maybe not in words, I'm not going to try this case, but we can't get a verdict in this case unless we have this expert. It's all is set out in all the correspondence that he said. And going back to 2001, if you'll look on Trial Exhibit AA, it sets a series of memos responding to Mr. Hawkins in the penitentiary because Mr. Hawkins would leave these messages and just, you know, demand answers and whatnot. So Jim would talk to him and then follow it up with memos where he's saying, we need another expert.
And
we
whose
can't
obligation is it to get the expert?
Jim.
And did he make any efforts to do so?
He contacted
after 2001?
Oh, yeah. He was, well, okay. Even before then. But he had got, basically, there are a series, or not a series, but there are well-known experts in these particular fields. One of them is Walter Kelsey, and I'm sure you've seen his name on numerous cases here. He's the go-to guy for mechanical engineering. Jim had, first of all, sent Jerry Nestor of our office out there and then called him several times after that. He got 3 no's from Mr. Kelsey. He would talk to other attorneys, talk to Chuck Haynes. I think he talked to a total of 5 people that are delineated in the record. And in addition, and your honors probably know how attorneys network, you're always on the lookout for talking to people, even in social settings, hearing of another case. You look at Lawyers Weekly to see if a case similar to yours has been decided, who the experts were. And
how much time has he had? Approximately, I know he's a plaintiff's lawyer, but how much time, approximately, would he have had in this case?
In this case? My best guesstimate is probably about 300 hours.
I mean, he collects nothing unless he gets a
nothing at all. That's correct. He doesn't get it. And in fact, he hasn't even sought to collect the balance of the expenses on the case from the clients.
Now, he's practicing for 40 years. Approximately how many cases would he have had since 1989 to the present?
Since 1990 to the present? Oh, our office goes through at least probably 300 to 500 cases per year.
300 to 500?
Yes.
In the office?
Yes. And we do a gamut. I mean, we do driving while intoxicated to all the way up to products liability.
So 300 to 500 cases a year for about 15 years since the last time he had a complaint.
And so
it's 3,000 to 4,500 cases of which there have been no complaint.
And I think if you look behind this case a little bit, Mr. Hawkins and Ms. Eckstein, you can tell by Mr. McCloskey's testimony. They were very contentious, angry. He called them unreasonably angry and hysterical people about this particular accident. And
there's a special investigator to come up with findings regarding that, Mr. McCloskey, right?
Mr. McCloskey was an attorney that Ms. Eckstein hired to look at a malpractice claim against Mr. Martin. He reviewed the case. He's also an expert in products liability, and he does attorney malpractice. He concluded that there was no viable case because of a lack of an expert to make that connection between the product defect and what happened on the roadway, that the case could not be made.
Mr. McCloskey's observation of the clients, though, occurred after the litigation had been pending for 14 years.
No, after, well, yes, ma'am. After they...
So the fact they were angry or upset about it at that point could have not resulted from them being difficult to deal with, simply that their attitudes developed during the 14 years.
Well, yes, but I think there's enough evidence from Mr. Martin's testimony. They were difficult to deal with because they couldn't, it seems like they didn't want to hear that the case was not triable in its present form. And they wanted vindication for their sons, not monetarily maybe so, but they wanted some kind of moral vindication, it seems to me, and this is my opinion, that their sons weren't to blame in this particular accident.
And you forces. Do set out that they failed to accept offers to settle from parties that appeared to have a basis for being dismissed out of the lawsuit.
Parties that it made no business sense to refuse their offer.
With relation to the aspect that they lost their sons, many times people want their day in court to just vindicate for a sense of justice or a sense of openness to the fact they did tragically lose their sons in the accident.
Correct. And Jim was trying to give them that day in court. And here again, the 14 years, if you look at it from the point of view of the way the litigation went, it wasn't until after 2001 that the case, and it sat. It sat because Jim was unable to take it forward to any kind of a good resolution. And he had an
alternative. Did he tell him that, though, that he wouldn't file it? I mean, he wouldn't try it unless they got another expert, as opposed to saying, gosh, it's then, we don't have that good a chance? Because those are very different statements, aren't they?
Well, no, because it never came to that. They never told us, if you're not going to try, they never asked him, if you're not going to try this, we want you to get out of the case. Or it never got to that. They would say, why isn't the case on the trial docket? He would respond, don't. And they were actually contacting the court directly. And they would actually contact the court directly and see if they could get it on the trial docket. There's a letter in our amended appendix that says, don't do that. You're going to get it inadvertently set for trial, and we're not ready. We cannot go to trial because we don't have a necessary witness.
Does your client agree that the combination of circumstances of the case and of not responding to authorities would warrant a reprimand, but disagrees that it would warrant suspension or greater discipline?
Well, I got to tell you, I don't think he agrees at all that there was any lack of due diligence or communications with the clients.
Now, what about the disciplinary counsel? You said he agreed.
There's got to be some payment for that.
What?
There has to be something for that, and I think your honors could very easily give him an admonishment for that.
This court doesn't give admonishments. That's prior to an information being filed that admonishments are.
Then we would ask
the public reprimand
for the least strict kind of disciplinary action possible. He would ask that you consider that for this action. But as far as the due diligence,
and he won't do that again.
He will never do that again.
What about the oral contingent fee?
That's an interesting issue. And here again, Mr. Martin, in his answer to the information, said that he believed that Mr. Hawkins and he had an oral contract. Ms. Eckstein testified that she had a written contract. Now, the way that he got this case was that he kind of inherited it from the Luco law firm on the east side of the river. So, and there actually may have been a written contingency fee contract with the attorney, but we can't find it.
But is it general practice and procedure to have written agreements?
Standard operating procedure is to have a written contract that spells out the expenses and whatnot, which Ms. Eckstein had because she knew exactly the terms of that contract. So it might have had something to do with the fact, too, that Mr. Hawkins was in the penitentiary and all of his communications were verbally. Of course, you know, letters could have been sent and they could have been signed. They may have been. Couldn't locate it at the time. The 14 years of that particular lawsuit was pending, it was just a function of getting to the point up through 2001 where Jim realized there's an expert here that we can't find, nobody can find, Mr. McCluskey couldn't find, Mrs. Eckstein said that she looked and tried to get other attorneys to take the case on, the expert's not out there. If he is, and somebody finds him, and if the case was still on the docket, then you'd be able to go to trial. But that's the only way that case was going to be tried by anybody who does products liability cases. So based upon that, I would ask the court to find that there was no lack of due diligence. He tried this case hard. He did everything he can. And if his lawyers, I think it's our duty to represent our clients zealously within the bounds of ethics and the law. And we also are bound to keep their claims and to assert their claims as far as we possibly can. In this particular case, and I know the courts hate to see cases just hanging around, but to preserve their rights, the best thing that could have happened was for that case to sit there as long as nobody was bringing up a motion to dismiss or a motion to set it for trial and see if you could develop anything. That was communicated to the client.
What if they had gone to trial without the expert? Would he have been liable for some kind of malpractice?
Well, I think the clients would have filed a bar complaint against them like they did here today.
Didn't they have an obligation to tell them they didn't have a case and get it over with? I mean, rather than keeping them along there for all that period of time?
He didn't think that they didn't have a case. He thinks that they have a case, and he believes in that case. He thinks that that thing was a defective product.
But
the problem was finding the necessary expert to tie it up.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but your client testified, quote, maybe the best thing would have been to fold up the tent and say, sorry, folks, there's not enough here. Goodbye.
Well, and here again, that's one of the things that I believe that counsel for the informant says that he conceded that he should have said that. If you're looking at page 255 of the transcript.
248 of the transcript.
Okay. I think they cite 255 for the fact that he conceded that he should have told them that they and dismissed the case. I don't think that. I think if you read that on page 255, beginning on line 14 and go all the way down, that's not what he says or means.
But look at page 248 of the transcript, and I gave a verbatim quote.
Okay.
And you don't have to waste your time now, but
oh, okay.
You can look at it later.
I'm sorry, I didn't look at that. But the other one, if I can point you to that, if you read it in context, he doesn't say that he's conceding there's a lack of due diligence in proceeding. His response should be read like this. Yeah, the diligence means I should have told them we don't have a case in 2002. That's the diligence. I should have walked away from them and abandoned them. Then it would have been dumped out just like it happened to them after he was rude. And if you read the rest of it, he was hanging in there. And not only was he telling them that you need another expert, he was inviting them to get another attorney if he thought that they could find somebody who could do better than him, who could get another counsel. But he knew, and he told them, if in fact he was rude from the case, exactly what happened when he did withdrew happened. The case was dismissed. And so he kept himself in there. He kept their case alive on the hope that something could be made of it. Well, that's representing them zealously. That's representing them diligently, even though they didn't appreciate it, even though they feel that they should be able to go into court and get a verdict today with what they have. Thank you.
Mr. Pretzel, should we read something into the fact that committee said the panel said 1 month suspension. Surely they had to know that was unusual, even if they thought it was authorized, that they thought it was less than the normal conduct that merits suspension.
Your Honor, I don't really read anything into that. It could be that they thought a 1 month stay suspension was allowable.
I mean, it seems like they thought it was barely over the line of a reprimand, so they made this very short suspension, but would stay it.
Well, I will say this. First of all, as we know, that a 6 month is the minimum that this court would order. From the point of view of protecting the public and the integrity of the bar, it's the informant's position that some sort of probationary period is appropriate. It's not the state suspension that we're concentrating on, but at this point, we think that we ought to be allowed to monitor Mr. Martin's practice for a period of time, a year.
Is there any suggestion there are other cases that are like this that he's representing people in?
No. Well, nothing on the record, no.
How long is ethics school? How long does ethics school
Ethics school is two full days. There's pre-class work and post-class follow-up as currently planned, Your Honor. I might add a couple of things. I'm just going to hop around a little bit. First of all, Judge Heidelman, you mentioned that there was no expert. In fact, Mr. Martin was able to get his clients past the motion for summary judgment filed by Chrysler because he did have an expert. The expert was not someone he felt he could go to trial with, but he got past the motion for summary judgment.
Summary judgment doesn't get you past directed verdicts, though.
No, it certainly doesn't. But by the same token, what we're arguing here is you've got a client, they've lost two sons, they're... You know, Mr. McCloskey said they were agitated, that they were hysterical. They've lost two sons. They've waited for their day in court for 14 years, and they never get it. And they're never told that their attorney isn't going to give it to them. They're only told that their attorney needs to go out and get some more evidence. You know, under the circumstances, I think that it's a clear 1.3 violation for diligence. He he attempted to get some experts. He was in contact with experts. They never panned out. And I think at some point you have to fish or cut bait. You have to get out of the representation. For goodness sakes, 14 years, you know, there's antitrust cases that get tried quicker than this case was ever going to get tried. So
sometimes you have to tell your client what they don't want to hear.
Exactly right. And Judge Russell, you were exactly right. The quote from the transcript, he did say that at one point. Maybe I should have just said, I'm out of here. Goodbye. Sorry.
Well, was he just meaning that would have been some point saved everybody a lot of trouble, as it turns out? Or was he saying he was wrong not to do it?
I don't know what he was thinking, but I know this. I think he had an obligation to do that if that's what he believed. And I think waiting 14 years and never getting the case to trial, which is the purpose of the representation, by the way, not to drag it on and protect the claim, but to get it to trial, waiting for 14 years, to me, says I'm not ever trying this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.